What are digital devices doing to our children? In Technology's Child, Digital Media's Role in the Ages and Stages of Growing Up, author Katie Davis helps parents and educators provide good tech guidance to children. Katie is a professor at the University of Washington and writes about the impact of technology on education and society. Here she is to share five of her big ideas.
Hi there. My name is Katie Davis. I'm excited to share with you some key insights from my latest book, Technology's Child, Digital Media's Role in the Ages and Stages of Growing Up. I come to this book wearing two hats. My first hat is my role as a professor at the University of Washington, where I direct the Digital Youth Lab. For nearly 20 years, I've been researching the impact of digital technologies on young people's learning, development, and well-being. My second hat is a parent. My son Oliver was 2 when I started writing Technology's Child, and 5 when I finished. He features prominently in the beginning chapters focused on early childhood. As a researcher, I've always enjoyed engaging with the challenge of understanding technology's complicated role in child development. And for most of my career, when non-researchers ask me for the verdict, is technology good or bad for kids, I typically answered by saying something like, it depends, or it's complicated. But when I became a parent 6 years ago, I quickly realized that these kinds of answers weren't particularly helpful to me as a parent. How was I supposed to translate it depends into an acceptable number of daily Paw Patrol episodes for Oliver? How is it's complicated going to help me figure out when to introduce him to video games or when to let him have a phone? It was this tension between my researcher hat and my parent hat that motivated me to write Technology's Child. I wanted to explore whether there was anything concrete to be distilled from this complex research landscape that parents and others like teachers, policymakers, and tech designers could use to support children's positive experiences with technology. So this book is my attempt to bring my researcher self and my parent self together and make the complex a little bit more concrete. Insight number 1. Relying on technology is not the same as thriving with technology. The coronavirus pandemic, in combination with other contemporary events, has given rise to a new readiness to engage with the topic of kids and technology on a deeper level than the months and years before March 2020. Before the pandemic, the questions were pretty straightforward. We were asking things like screens, are they good or bad for children's development? And screen time, how much is too much? But when we moved our lives online in 2020, we quickly learned that asking whether screens and screen time are good or bad are not the right questions. Technology has become too central to our lives. The pandemic has given rise to a new readiness to engage with the topic of kids and technology on a deeper level. Now the questions include, when does technology support children's healthy development and when does it not? Why do some children benefit from technology and others don't? For instance, the pandemic called attention to the fact that while we all may rely on technology, we don't all enjoy equal access to it. When school buildings closed and classes moved online, we learned about the stark differences between kids living in affluent homes, whose circumstances ensured they had access to high-speed internet, a dedicated computer, a quiet space to work, and a network of supportive people to help keep them on track, and kids living in low-income homes or rural homes, who too often had none of these things. These stark differences in children's pandemic experiences exposed and amplified existing inequities in our educational system, forcing us to ask, which children benefit most from technology and why? In the last quarter of 2021, the leaking of internal Facebook documents by former Facebook employee Frances Haugen shone a light on the power of opaque algorithms to shape our experiences on social media platforms. Although this power had been well documented previously, the media coverage surrounding the Facebook files helped bring it more directly into public consciousness. The public became more aware of how algorithms designed to attract and hold our attention to platforms like Facebook and Instagram, and also platforms like Snapchat, Twitter, TikTok, and YouTube, can contribute to the spread of misinformation, hate speech, and the undermining of teens' mental health, preparing us to grapple with the question, how does the design of a technology shape the way children use it and are affected by it? This question brings us to insight number two. Technology design matters. Technology is not neutral. The autoplay feature on Netflix makes it that much easier for children to watch multiple episodes of a television show, and that much harder for parents to avoid a confrontation when they seek to turn off the device. When a show ends, recommender algorithms on Netflix and YouTube, Disney Plus, and other video streaming platforms determine what a child encounters next. Algorithms also determine the videos that show up on a teen's For You feed on TikTok, and the pictures they see as they scroll through their Instagram feed. These algorithms are designed to draw and keep people's attention based on the information they've collected from their prior interactions with the platform. People design things like autoplay and social media algorithms. Their values, goals, and assumptions are baked into what they create. Importantly, tech designers don't reflect the full diversity of the kids they're designing for. They tend to be disproportionately white, male, and highly educated. So when they think about a typical user, that person is more likely to resemble them than not, and this increases the chances that the technology they create serves some people better than others. The companies that tech designers work for also have their own sets of values, goals, and assumptions. And most centrally, these companies are motivated by the bottom line, not necessarily a child's well-being. The bottom line does well when people are on the platform, and companies have figured out the kind of content that keeps people engaged. That tends to be emotionally arousing posts, which typically win out over measured accounts of fact. This is why Facebook's algorithm prioritizes content with angry emojis over likes. Insight number three. Individual children matter. Research involving large numbers of children is valuable because it gives us an overall impression of general trends in a population. It's also a useful way to identify systemic differences that lead to common disparities among subpopulations in a society. But there's a limit to the value that can be drawn from general trends. That's because the statistical models that form the basis of population-based research typically rely on averages. Let's consider a hypothetical example involving the relationship between social media use and body satisfaction in teen girls. If you wanted to use the amount of time teen girls spend on social media sites like Instagram to predict how positively or negatively they feel about their bodies, you could generate a bunch of dots on a graph, each one representing an individual teen girl's time spent on Instagram, which would be a value on the x-axis, and their score on a measure of body satisfaction, which would be a value on the y-axis. Next, you draw a line that goes through the middle of these dots such that the distance between all of the dots falling above the line and all of the dots falling below the line is about the same. You'd use that line, not the dots that generated it, to draw conclusions about the relationship between Instagram use and teen girls' body image. If it were falling steeply to the right, you'd conclude there's a generally strong negative relationship between Instagram use and body satisfaction, which is not good. If it were dipping gently upward, you'd conclude there's a generally weak positive relationship, which is better. These lines would let you make an informed guess about a specific teen girl's body satisfaction based on the amount of time they spend on Instagram. The problem is, you'd probably be wrong. Maybe not as wrong as pulling a value out of thin air, but still wrong. It turns out that very few people, if any, ever land exactly on the trend line. It turns out very few people are average. Averages are good at describing behavior on a group level, but considerably less effective at describing the behavior of individual children. This example illustrates why a one-size-fits-all approach to kids and technology doesn't work. We need to look at specific children, specific technologies, and specific contexts if we want to truly understand what's going on with technology's role in child development. Insight number four, context matters. Understanding child development requires understanding the communities and cultural practices that children participate in. Cultural communities shape our impression of what's considered dangerous and what's considered beautiful. What counts as intelligent or athletic or funny, and how intelligence, athleticism, and humor are expressed. I'll give you an example from my own experience. I wrote most of Technology's Child while living in Berlin, where many preschool teachers don't think twice about letting 3- and 4-year-olds use hammers, nails, and saws to work unsupervised with wood planks. I'm quite sure that this would lead to a lawsuit in the Seattle neighborhood I now live in. Children participate in a lot of different spaces, settings, and communities, each one containing different configurations of people, practices, roles, and expectations. Understanding how the cultural practices across these contexts relate to each other and how they connect to broader societal institutions and ideologies is crucial. So let's return to the example of teen girls' social media and body image. To do better than an average trend line at predicting the relationship between Instagram use and body satisfaction for a particular teen girl, it would help to have some understanding of her experiences with her peers and family members. What kinds of beauty ideals are promoted by each group of people, and how do they draw on, reinforce, or perhaps push back against broader cultural ideologies related to beauty? How do these dynamics influence what she sees and how she interprets content on Instagram? Does this teen participate in other communities, such as a church group, sports team, or after-school club, that de-emphasize physical appearance and elevate other qualities such as teamwork, spirituality, and community? How do this teen's racial identity and the degree to which it's either marginalized or centered in the broader society influence whether and how she compares herself to the images she sees on Instagram? Questions like these highlight the importance of considering young people's varied social context, how these contexts relate to each other and the technologies used in them, and how all of these contexts are influenced by broader social, political, economic, and historical forces. Insight number 5, good enough can be great. In Technology's Child, I introduced the concept of the good enough digital parent. The idea comes from a pediatrician, Donald Winnicott, who wrote in the middle of the 20th century. Back then, Winnicott wrote about the good enough mother, but let's update it for the 21st century and talk about the good enough parent. Winnicott argued that the goal of parenting is not perfection, but rather good enough. In fact, he said, you're doing your child a disservice if you're always on hand to solve their problems or soothe them when they're frustrated or upset or offer up a new activity if they become bored with the current one. By experiencing and working through the frustration that accompanies these moments of disappointment or boredom, children can build resilience that will prepare them for the challenges they'll inevitably encounter throughout their lives. Good enough parenting isn't about making excuses for failing to live up to one's ideals as a parent. It's about recognizing that we should not even attempt to be the perfect parent. First, and most obviously, perfection isn't possible, or at least it can't be sustained throughout the long and often unpredictable course of childhood. More importantly, according to Winnicott, it's not in a child's best interest for their parents to be always attentive, because this attentiveness doesn't allow room for personal growth. I see the concept of the good enough parent as a call to parents not to settle for imperfection, but actually to embrace it, both as a way to support their children's resilience and as a way to stay sane during the exhilaration and exhaustion of parenthood. A good enough digital parent similarly doesn't settle for imperfection, but embraces it. They do their best to steer their kids towards positive technology experiences, knowing that not everything will be of equally high quality. They make mistakes, learn from them, and move on. When it comes to their own technology use, good enough parents will feel confident that occasionally being distracted by a screen or other device isn't the end of the world and not the end of their child's prospects for a happy, fulfilling life. Good enough parents also recognize that their distraction isn't all they're doing. Tech companies have designed their products deliberately to grab our attention. Distraction could even sometimes be a good thing, both for parents and for children, provided the concept of good enough parenting isn't distorted and used as an excuse to shirk parenting duties in the name of responding to emails or monitoring one's social media feed. And this is by no means an attempt to let tech companies off the hook for their persuasive designs. The occasional distraction could provide an opportunity for parents to call attention to their behavior and create a teachable moment. Oh, look, I've let myself get distracted by my phone. Let me put that away and let's get back to where we were. With Oliver, I do my best to limit my phone use around him, but I'm also trying not to place too much guilt on my shoulders when I sneak a peek at news headlines, or if I exchange messages with a friend or check my email inbox. These interactions sometimes feel like a lifeline, a way to connect with the outside world, the adult world, and maintain my sense of self beyond my role as a mother. Thanks for listening, and I hope you enjoy reading Technology's Child.
Thank you, Katie. That was Katie Davis with 5 Big Ideas from Technology's Child, Digital Media's Role in the Ages and Stages of Growing Up. Also, check out our book bite for Behind Their Screens, What Teens Are Facing and Adults Are Missing. I'm Michael Kovnat. Thanks for listening.